This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
This is not going to be a short deployment. This is going to be weeks and weeks and weeks. This is going to be a long day. And it's going to be a hard day. And it's going to be an ugly day. And it's going to be a sad day.
But even as the death toll mounts on American soil, is war what we're waging, even metaphorically?
Today we reached a historic milestone in our war against the coronavirus.
We certainly have the fog of war.
Over 1 million Americans have now been tested.
And we have wartime propaganda.
More than any other country, by far, not even close.
But President Trump's numbers have been widely questioned, with the U.S. well behind Italy and South Korea in the number of people tested.
Well, this is World War C, World War Coronavirus.
And we have the virus on every continent except Antarctica.
In this fight, we can be in no doubt that each and every one of us is directly enlisted.
But is our reliable stockpile of war metaphors, with its explosions and weaponry, soldiers and supply lines, the best vocabulary for framing what's going on? I mean, for those of us who aren't health workers in hospitals, just people sheltering in place. This is a real question.
The captain of a U.S. aircraft carrier says more of his sailors are testing positive for coronavirus. Captain Brett Crozer is calling on Navy leaders to take stronger measures to save the sailors' lives.
He wrote, quote, "We are not at war. Sailors do not need to die."
Rather than saying we're fighting in a war, maybe it would be more useful to say we're being trampled by a gray rhino. Risk expert Michelle Walker coined that metaphor to describe an obvious, highly probable, yet strangely neglected danger.
So I was trying to come up with an image. I was brainstorming with a friend. And I said, it's big. It's coming right at you. It's dangerous, you know, like with a horn. And that's when the rhino popped into my head.
Rhinos don't appear every day, but unlike those far-fetched, unforeseeable black swans, we know they exist, and that all of them, whether black or white, are basically gray and perilous. And they're not stealthy. Any world power could see one coming if they had the guts to face inconvenient truths. I pulled the gray rhino out of a blog post on metaphors written by University of Nottingham prof Brigitte Nerlich. Other recent treatments of the metaphor dilemma could be found in The Guardian, The Atlantic, and The New Yorker. Metaphors are much on our minds because by framing the issues, they can shape policy. And obviously, COVID-19 is framed mostly in metaphors of war. In past shows, we've observed how other metaphorical wars, on cancer, for example, or on drugs, did little to vanquish those problems and may have even impeded the efforts to address them. This hour, we explore the suitability of the war metaphor, politically, economically, historically, and personally.
$16 billion to buy the supplies we need to win this war.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster.
The special forces in this war are your nurses and your doctors and your healthcare professionals. They're the ones that meet the disease every day, head on. The rest of us are soldiers in this fight.
At 7 o'clock every night, New Yorkers, like many others around the world, head to their windows, balconies, roofs, and front stoops to applaud those special forces on the front lines. Wars, even the most ruinous wars, have heroes. those often of low station who sacrifice out of proportion to how the society has treated them. Indeed, one of the collateral benefits of war is that those heroes are celebrated for their courage by those who had never really ever seen them before. Health workers are our heroes, and right behind them, the mail carriers, sanitation workers, and grocery clerks, all essential, all recognized now as crucial parts of the mechanism that holds communities together. Jeet Heer wrote a piece in The Nation this week about how these workers are being empowered by crisis to demand better conditions, equality, and justice. Not for the first time.
I think the most clear-cut case here is the Civil War, where Lincoln initially started with the goal of preserving the Union with or without slavery, but was moved towards the abolitionist position by the argument that freeing the slaves would weaken the South, but also that Black American soldiers were a crucial part of the war effort, and that you cannot ask these soldiers to sacrifice for no reason. Even after the Civil War, there was a very strong push for pensions. And then in subsequent wars, you had things like the GI Bill after the Second World War. You had the building up the VA, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan. Every time there's a war, society has to come to terms with what do we owe the people who are making sacrifices.
The workers on the front lines are being referred to as heroes. But here's the thing. Unlike volunteer army or the fire department, a frontline nursing assistant or a supermarket cashier hasn't signed up for heroism. They've signed up for a low-wage job.
It's not something that they signed up for. I mean, that's absolutely correct. It's not like the volunteer army. I think it's more like conscription, which is the more common experience of war in American history. And unfortunately, it's a war where they're not given the protection that they need, and they're not given the compensation that we would normally want to give our soldiers.
There's already some evidence of reaction to the status quo from workers who are kind of fed up being at high risk with low reward.
What we've seen is an upsurge of job actions, both official and what are called wildcat strikes that's not sanctioned by a union. And it's particularly pertinent at this point because, you know, unions are weaker now than they have been in more than a century. So we've seen a whole host of actions. There was the workers at Instacart, grocery delivery service, have called for a strike.
Today, several Instacart drivers around the nation went on a strike of sorts. They're refusing to fill orders until more is done to help keep them safe.
The Amazon warehouse on Staten Island threatened a walkout.
The organizers have said there have been 50 Amazon strikes across the country. The company said it's been more like 15.
And I believe Amazon fired a worker there.
A guy named Christopher Smalls from their Staten Island warehouse. He was the person who was organizing strikes.
In the Bath Ironworks, a shipyard in Maine, half the workers stayed at home to pressure their employers to clean up the shipyard. Bus drivers in Alabama went on a strike because they felt that they weren't being protected. So this is a nationwide movement of blue-collar workers who are withholding their labor to try to push for better conditions.
Now, we may not like to admit this, but demanding higher pay or benefits or any kind of consideration in the midst of a crisis carries with it a political risk. Those seeking economic justice or simply recognition of their contributions will be dismissed as opportunists or as unpatriotic or selfishly trying to cash in on the crisis. Here's conservative pundit Ben Shapiro.
If I were Amazon and I had the capacity, I'd fire everybody who strikes right now and I'd bring in workers who are willing to work. I would, because this is, it's unconscionable.
Is there not a danger of just feeding that narrative?
The issue we should focus on is justice. Is it actually just to ask people to do dangerous work without offering them compensation? And that seems very different than the case of a price gouger. And I want to just underscore something, which is that it's not just that people who are doing dangerous work aren't being compensated. Because of the economic recession, there's actually a real rollback of wages and compensation. And just yesterday, Altion Health, which is a major employer of doctors and nurses, announced that they were reducing hours, reducing pay, including pension, bonuses, and paid time off. And they're doing that because health companies can't make money off the coronavirus. They make money off of elective surgery. So we have this perverse situation where the very workers who are most at risk are actually seeing their compensation being cut back.
companies like Altion have quite a bit of cover in Congress. There are four senators, including Lindsey Graham, who have tried to resist the expansion of unemployment insurance. And, you know, what they say is kind of jaw-dropping.
So you're going to have all these well-trained nurses that are going to make $24 an hour on unemployment. You're literally incentivizing taking people out of the workforce at a time when we need critical infrastructure supplied with workers.
I think the proper answer to that is, if unemployment is more generous than working, then that kind of shows you're not paying nurses enough. It's very dire in terms of what this is going to do to the medical profession. And you already have doctors and nurses drawing up wills, trying to figure out who's going to take care of their kids. I honestly cannot understand the morality of denying compensation to people in that situation.
We've discussed in the past on this program two potential futures. One in which the crisis enables authoritarian-minded leaders to get even more autocratic, to govern by decree, and so on. The likelihood that once they've usurped that power, that they're loath at the end of the crisis to surrender it. But the other possible future seems to be defined by the package that the Congress, the $2 trillion package for a more socially just distribution of the nation's wealth. Post-pandemic, what do you think happens to the social contract?
We're going to see a couple of things happening simultaneously. A spike in unemployment, but also premiums are going to be likely to go up much higher, because health insurance companies are not really set up to deal with a pandemic. Also, many medical institutions like hospitals are going to face bankruptcy and going to have to be bailed out. So within those conditions, I think that there's the perfect parameter for radical overhaul of the healthcare system to make it universal and free. It doesn't help you to have great private health insurance during a pandemic if many other people don't. You're only as insured as the person who has the least health coverage, because if they get it and they're not treated, then the pandemic will spread. And I think the logic of the pandemic itself is going to force the social contract to change. One could have a nightmare scenario where there is a push towards authoritarianism, as we see in certain countries like Hungary right now. But there's always been also the other possibility of a push towards a more democratic system that's more inclusive, and that really offers people the protection of belonging to a shared collective project.
Jeet, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeet Heer is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation.
Coming up, the idea of war not only frames our thinking, it shapes our policy.
This is On the Media.